Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. Our podcast today is brought to you by the University of Hong Kong's RegTech Lab, as well as the HKU Standard Chartered Foundation's FinTech Academy, the Asia Global Institute, and HKU edX's Professional Certificate in FinTech, with support from the university's faculty at Wolf. Our guest today is Neha Mehta. She's currently a member of the Department of Mathematics at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. She also teaches in that institution's Master of Science program in FinTech. Among her key interests are financial inclusion, using FinTech as a vehicle to achieve it, as well as climate sustainability, innovating for a blue economy and a greener future, as well as encouraging more women to enter the tech space, as evidenced by her work with the group SG Women in Tech. Neha is also a FinTech lawyer, former diplomat, and an entrepreneur, in addition to being the author of the new book called One Stop. It's on the topic of super apps. A little bit more about the book. In the hustle and bustle of our world today, convenience and efficiency become hallmark appeals, even essential factors in many people's lives. New applications are churned out every day in response to this demand. But nothing says hassle-free more than super apps, apps that allow users to access several services from one single application. But super apps like Grab and WeChat gaining popularity in tech giants and fintechs looking to stake their claim in this digital revolution. Many might be wondering, what exactly are super apps? What is their significance in our world today? And are they the future of all things digital? In One Stop, Neha answers these questions by tracing the history of super apps and analyzing cultural differences in their adoption and popularity, or lack thereof, in both the East and West. Through stories of well-known super apps and in-depth interviews with central banks, entrepreneurs, and fintech industry experts, super apps illustrates the revolution of this space and the way it disrupts, innovates, and creates opportunities. With the COVID-19 pandemic as a background highlighting the need to move to digital platforms, One Stop also examines how super apps can potentially create an inclusive and sustainable world for all in a future that looks increasingly digital. And with that, Neha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ajay, for having me. It's a delight to be at the show, and we have been in touch for such a long time. I'm so glad we have finally managed to collaborate. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's Hong Kong and Singapore schedules for you, but we might have managed to end at a convenient time. Before we talk about you, let's talk about the book. What caused you to write it, and if you can flesh out your main points and conclusions for our readers, and what would they get from your book that they won't get elsewhere? Because at this point, fintech and crypto are not new things. It's a pretty saturated field. So yeah, tell us what's significant about the book to you.
Yeah, thanks, Ajay. This question is very important because I just had the global launch of the book, like you said, One Stop, in your introduction just today. Thank you. It's a good timing. So I decided to write a book on super apps because having worked in the fintech space for such a long time, I realized there's no literature on super apps. And you and I know this very well, having lived in Hong Kong and Singapore, and we travel back and forth in Asia. We tend to use these apps for pretty much everything under the sun. So it helps us to get to point A to B, send money across, make investments. And that's the solution for all our asks and needs. So just to share some numbers there, in China, people spend 90% of their time either on WeChat or Alipay. And according to a research, by 2025, world's 60% population would be using one of the super apps. So we are talking about a trend which is here to stay, especially when Elon Musk is saying he wants Twitter, the X, to be a super app, something similar to WeChat. So the reason was just about trying to spill the beans on how these apps came about in our life, why they matter so much to us. And beyond that, given my work in the financial inclusion space, I think super apps is the solution for the underbanked and unbanked, because that's where the legacy institutions are shy to go. And it becomes much more easier for women, youth, and marginalized communities to take up these apps and therefore build on their digital and credit history, because we are talking about people who don't really have access to an ID, forget a digital ID. And India has done a great job with a digital ID called Aadhaar, which is biometrics, your iris, and all those features. So I think a super app is definitely the answer for financial inclusion, financial resilience. And coming to your second question as to what it really brings forward, I think the fact that you will see these apps more in the Eastern world versus the Western world. There are many reasons for that. It could be simple things like culture, where we are, where we as Asians are far more likely to give away our data for the sake of loyalty points or convenience, whereas in the Western world, people are very reluctant to do so. And the other factor that is very easy to understand is around the specialization feature. So, for example, if you use Facebook, you would see the Messenger in Facebook is a different app. It's not part of the same app. So here we are talking about bringing everything under one umbrella or one ecosystem, but Facebook is trying to put away its crucial feature of messaging away from its main app. So this is how the Western world typically works. They're looking at specialization. And in the Eastern world, we tend to combine all these features in one under one umbrella, which is called the super apps. And that essentially also means that you would see a horizontal growth in the Eastern market, whereabout you will be adding a lot of features. But in the Western market, it's going to be vertical, where you would see these apps going in a particular vertical of finance or medical or insurance. So I think that's the beauty of super apps. And I have worked in the area of financial inclusion for a very long time. And I see firsthand how it's easy to just adopt one application and get good with it. So it's far more easier for me to tell my mom how to use a PhonePe or a Paytm rather than explaining multiple apps to her. So I think that's where the beauty is as well, because if you talk about world's fourth largest population, that's Indonesia, 90% of people there actually have an interface with the online world through a mobile device. They have never gone on a desktop. So we are talking about the transition from offline to online only on a mobile device, which leads to the stickiness to such apps, because it's far more easier for us to be using one app, whereas the Western world is more prone to be using a lot of devices, and therefore it becomes difficult for us to integrate all those facilities. So I think it's an easy read. Just about 2 days ago, I was at the World Book Fair signing some book copies, and people are very interested in the area of fintech. You spoke about how it is different from cryptos. Well, I'm not talking about digital tokens. I'm not touching upon Bitcoins. I'm purely talking about technology, which is here to stay. And I have given a thorough research on how these apps work across the globe. But also to keep it more interactive and, like I said, easy to read, the second section of the book is about the interviews with the regulators, with the industry professionals, founders, venture capitalists, so that people get to see how different stakeholders in this ecosystem look at super apps and whether they really think it's going to be staying here in the future or not.
Yeah, your point about the Aadhaar card is well taken. I recently had to go to Bombay and while there the Airtel office in Lokhandwala in Andheri West, I hadn't been back in years because of the pandemic. I needed to get my chip, well, a new SIM card. And so whereas previously that might have required a photograph and a passport copy, and now just the Aadhaar card was enough. So that greatly simplified things. And I, unfortunately, you know, I didn't have it at the time, but I went and got it. But yeah, had I had it, it would have greatly, greatly simplified things. So, a little bit about yourself, your life before your current life in Singapore. I mean, where did you grow up and how did you find your way into the legal profession and ultimately the world of tech, being such a tech entrepreneur and advocate?
Yeah, thanks, Ajay. I'm glad you mentioned about Bombay because it's one of my favorite cities in India. And perhaps it's a giveaway with my name as well. I come from India. I grew up in the capital city, but originally I'm from Agra. That's where I was born. Spent some years in Bangalore, the tech capital of the country. And as you can imagine, in the early 80s, growing up in India, you see the discrimination between men and women, boy and girl at school. And it never felt like you really belong. I was incredibly lucky that my father gave my sister and myself a great upbringing and made us feel empowered. But I would say it still was not an equal world. And therefore, getting into the legal profession only made sense because it helps you understand your legal rights. It empowers you and certainly puts you in a place where you feel that you can fight your own battle. So I started off thinking I'm going to be a great litigation lawyer, perhaps helping women with their dowry cases or whatnot. But I think destiny had a different plan for me. I went on to do a legal internship in Singapore. And that's when I got the Singapore bug. And I felt that this is the place where I feel celebrated. I feel equal to men. And I would love to come back and work here full time. But I graduated in 2008. I think no one really needs to ask why it was a tough time for the economy. But right after 2008, it was incredibly hard to find a job. But I was fairly blessed to have a couple of job offers and started my career as a lawyer in Singapore. But because I was working in the finance sector, in private equity, venture capital, and hedge funds, it was fairly easy for me to understand the intersection of law, technology, and finance, and how the interplay of these things works with the overarching role of financial inclusion.
That's the core of our show, the intersection between law and technology and finance. But, you know, I see many lawyers in this space, and this is going to be the subject of an upcoming episode of Regulatory Ramblings, just to give people a bit of a preview. So many lawyers are advising in this space, and they're not techies. They don't have technical backgrounds. Okay. If you talk to some lawyers, some law professors in this town, they will tell you, okay, well, typically it's a dispute resolution lawyer. They have a client. The client happens to have a dispute that exists in the tech space or has a tech angle to it, and that's how they get involved. And as long as, you know, they're advising on the legal aspects, that's okay. Others would say no, that the fact that technology is involved changes the rules of the game. It changes the nature of the conversation. For example, we have the patent bar in the U.S. And to sit for that, you have to have a STEM degree, or you have to have engineering or a hard science background. Some would say at the very minimum, therefore, lawyers in this space should have a STEM degree. That's not to say someone who, I mean, the chief judge, I believe, of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in the U.S., Judge Rader, has an English literature background. But he is one of the most knowledgeable people in the field of patent law in the U.S. and all the world. So that's not to say someone can't come up to speed. But what are your thoughts on non-technically trained lawyers advising clients on matters, on technical matters or matters implicating technology?
That's a good question, Ajay. But let me tell you that I am more on the regulatory side. So I've worked with the regulators on advising on policies which could be helping the underbanked and unbanked, so more sustainable development goal focused. But to answer,
so more on the compliance, more on the policy side than
on the policy side, yes.
Right.
But I think something I have figured out in my life very early on is that the technology is evolving. it changes as we speak, and no one can claim to be a full expert in that area. Of course, you can pick up a course and you can claim yourself to have a certificate that allows you to do a certain style of work. But beyond that, it's all about keeping yourself abreast with what's happening in the tech world. And more often than not, there are changes happening very quickly in a particular jurisdiction that has global repercussions. And I'm saying this particularly in the space of, let's say, IC and STOs that we have gone through. I mean, Singapore market has been fairly great in terms of giving clarity to the retail investors, but a lot of these jurisdictions play in the gray area. So is it right for us to, for lawyer fraternity to give advice to clients without having full understanding of how things work? Perhaps not, but who is claiming to be an expert in this area? People who just have, let's say, 70% or 85% of knowledge, because like I said, there's always room for new things coming up, which is evolving. And at the same time, I think when we look at the landscape of fintech, of cryptocurrencies, or in that aspect, climate tech, things are not the same anymore, because a new technology comes up and what you learned previously for a particular area of work seems redundant to you. And like we say, with artificial intelligence, 40% of jobs are going to be redundant very soon. So what does that mean? It simply means upskilling and reskilling. And that's the idea I think all of us should have, regardless of what profession we are. We should be ready to embrace change, and we should be ready to ask questions, because that's the great medium to learn new things.
Okay. That's very true. As the message being sent out to everyone, particularly professional, particularly educated people, is learners learn. Learning is going to be a lifelong occupation. You can't sit on the credentials you've gotten. And so you've gone, as you said, you've got to constantly be upskilling, up-tooling. But having said that, the person who's got, they may have gotten a law degree from a good institution, an LLM perhaps, an MBA even. But to say then that they're going to tack on, you know, the Oxford, you know, certificate, or the Duke University certificate in, or the MIT certificate in fintech or AI, and then masquerade as an expert in this field, that is increasingly what I'm seeing, that some of the loudest people in the profession, they may not be techies, but they're getting the biggest platforms, whereas the real knowledgeable people are just crunching away, getting stuff done, serving their clients. And there's no way in hell that someone who's just gotten a law degree and then gotten those certificates in fintech and regtech and AI, that you're going to have the same degree of confidence in them as, say, someone who worked for IBM. I'm talking about people I know now. Someone who worked for IBM on the software side and the hardware side, then got their law degree, then became a professor. The clients aren't fools. They're going to look at those two different backgrounds and say, okay, I know whom I'd rather be speaking with. And to your point about AI taking jobs, it seems to me that the people who are going to be most afflicted are going to be the low-skilled white-collar workers more so than the blue-collar workers. But if you're a copy editor or certain researchers or a personal assistant or paralegal, yeah, then you may need to work. But it's, you know what, Nia, what strikes me is it seems to me increasingly that your job is not necessarily going to be taken away from you by AI. It's going to be taken away from you by another human being using AI. And so the paramount question becomes, how well do you work with technology? How well does your knowledge, do your skills and creativity complement the outputs we can get from technology? And if the answer is in the affirmative, you have a future. If not, you know, the future may be bleak. And case in point, to effectively use ChatGPT, you have to know the subject matter very well to be able to ask specific pointed questions. Otherwise, you get, you know, gobbledygook. It's, and I would even use the analogy of studying, you know, an open book versus a memorization test, that if I have studied well enough, maybe if I would have, if it was a closed book exam, I might only have gotten a B or an A minus. But if I've studied well enough and I know the subject matter, I know what to look for during the test in my notes in my book, I can conceivably get an A or higher. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is exactly what the discussion was at the Singapore FinTech Festival in November last year, where President Thurman of Singapore was talking about how the seniors of the society need to embrace the technology.
Right.
And this is just to ensure that we leave no one behind. Because the world is changing in such a fashion that if you say, hey, look, I'm not going to use this new technology, I'd rather do the old way, you're just closing the door on yourself. So I think, like you said, a human being using AI is going to take away that job. So what is the solution? You go back and you say, look, I know things are changing very quickly and I'm going to start one day or day one, right? So this could be your day one on learning and you continue learning. And I think that's exactly what I do every day because I don't have answers to all the questions. It has to be a beginner's and the learner's mindset. So you have to be open to ask questions, to learn, and to be okay to say, look, I don't know the answer for this. I will do some research and get back to you. So I think having that humility and that eagerness to learn is what's going to take us forward.
It's interesting you mentioned that humility because there was one lawyer we were dealing with once, that, and this person had graduated some years ago from Harvard. And he was, you know, a big name in his time. But what you were saying, that the responsible, the mature thing to do, the professional thing to do would be to say, I don't know, let me get back to you. And then delve into the problem is the appropriate thing to do, as opposed to someone who came of age at a certain time and you can't show weakness, you can't show ignorance in front of a client. And so this person... One could say they might even have been guilty of malpractice because they failed to acknowledge things that had changed in the field and the profession since they had gone to law school. And most of the time they could get by it, but it's that, you know, until that approach works until it doesn't. It's interesting because I remember lawyers don't like change. And I remember one of my, my advisor in law school once said that, the legal profession, the common law world, you're speaking the U.S., but I think this applies to lawyers in general, certainly the common law world, that he said that our profession produces too many moral and intellectual weaklings who think that by taking tests, getting a degree, getting their practicing certificate, you know, passing the bar exam, getting their license, that with that card in their pocket, society will continue to pay them a comfortable living, and that they can get by with just bamboozling their clients with a little bit of Latin, a little bit of, you know, a little bit of old French, you know, yesterday's forms, you know, the formalities of the profession. And thereafter, society will continue to give them respect and an easy living. As opposed to the lawyer who says, no, I've got to adapt and change. And that requires, you know, being a business advisor. You know, that requires business savvy on the part of the lawyer. A lot of people don't want to learn more and add more value. That they think it's a learned profession. What they bring to the table should be enough. And sadly, those are the people who seem to be the loudest in the profession, certainly in the fintech space. The people who they know the law aspects, but less so about the technology, and that's dangerous because without a practical knowledge of the technological aspects, you can't really advise someone on implementation or the market issues thereof.
Absolutely, I agree. I think in order to give a holistic and a full overview, you need to understand all the intricacies. And I think as a lawyer, it's a fiduciary duty to have that kind of knowledge and to keep your client's interest first and give them the right set of advice. But like I said, I think in the space of criminal litigation or civil litigation that has been there for many years. There are case laws. You can go back to that. They are the precedents. And you do some legal research. You can find some common areas and say, hey, look, my case is exactly what was decided in 1925, 1950. Therefore, this is what you have got to do now as well. Do we have those kind of settings now? No, because we are venturing into new spaces, new areas where we don't know ourselves how we're going to do this. So I think figuring it out is one of it, but also just using your own common sense and connecting the dots and saying, look, this is how I think it's going to be done. But at the same time, I think if you look at any boardroom discussions or anything that really is about decision making, it's just about bringing people from all walks of life together and then deciding how to do it best. Because I remember when I was leading team of 100 in Fiji Islands, doing some really fresh, innovative ideas at the grassroots level, most of us were unsure of the success, but we were sure if you don't try, then there is no success. So right. Sometimes with a very limited knowledge and our fingers crossed and giving our best, we're just hoping that this is going to help the Pacific Islanders, because we are dealing with issues of rising sea level. And this is what we think this project is going to solve going forward. So I think sometimes the unknown knowns are okay as long as you know that can be known unknown.
Interesting you mentioned the criminal law aspect. I mean, yeah, if we're talking about something that's, you know, a core common law doctrinal subject, if it's largely legal matter, that's one thing. But even, you know, here, law students freak out because the exams they're given bear a strong resemblance to the cases they've studied. Some instances a teacher may tweak in the fact pattern they're given on their law school exams. But in practice, the trouble seems to be, okay, there's precedent, but it's not a case on all fours, and that it doesn't exactly completely match the fact pattern that I'm facing, and that requires some degree of creativity, you know, reasoning through analogy, and some people have that, some people don't. And it's what you're saying, we're adding into a new space, you know, things are uncertain. It would seem to me that precisely in that scenario, that creativity of the common law practitioner is required. Let me be more concrete. Years ago, around about, you know, almost 20 years ago now, when I audited a course in cybercrime, the instructor said to us up front, the professor said, you may think this is a new domain and so the old rules don't apply, but no. What we're going to be looking at is, you're going to be applying common law definitions of crimes to the cyber realm. And it's up to you to decide how it applies and to tease out those elements. So in a sense, you're applying what you already know. But again, it requires some degree of creativity to be able to apply that to that new domain, to that new realm. And yeah, I mean, in that sense, You need people who know the rules. They need to have that base legal knowledge, but then they also need to be able to take it forward in a new milieu, in a new setting. And it seems to me not everyone is capable of that level. Not everyone is capable of that level of thinking. And so yeah, there are lawyers. You know, it could be. There are law professors in this town. It could be 2024, it could be 1924. They'd rather it be 1924, even though there are some professors continuing on now who act like it's 1924. They'd rather it be 1924 because their jobs would be more secure, because now more is being asked of them in this new world because of technology.
I was reading this article that around 200 people have been made redundant for a law firm because now they think that softwares like ChatGPT and the ones that are more suited for the legal world could be used, and they don't really need the legal associate. So imagine if we don't have legal associate, who are going to be the partners in 10 years, 10 years from now? Because if you are ripping them off the opportunity to start off as a junior and then gain the experience to go up the ladder. So I think it's a a chicken and egg situation where we might say that, look, technology is taking away jobs. At the same time, there are people who have become literally overnight stars by using TikTok and cashing into this short attention span that we have these days. So I think it's just about whether you look at it as an opportunity or a problem.
Certainly what you're describing could lead to the legal profession becoming more stratified. But I do think they won't have the chance to enter the profession, get mentored if they're being fired while they're still associates, and building those relationships and having a continued viable career in the legal space or even investment banking comes down to those relationships. And if you don't get that mentorship, you don't have that ability to build the relationships within the profession and also to cultivate your own client base, then yeah, in a sense, it seems as though you're being cut down in your prime. So I really don't know what's going to happen to these young people.
Yeah, I think we'll just have to wait and watch. There's no perfect answer to this.
You're also interested in matters of financial inclusion, climate, sustainability, innovations for the green economy and women in tech. Some would say these fields are connected. Some would say, let me put the question to you. Are these fields connected? It seems to me the common thread seems to be making the world a better place. Others would say, no, they're insular, they're discrete, they're disparate. I mean, are they, in your view, are these fields connected? And if so, how so?
Yeah, I think the common thread would be the economic growth, whether we are trying to empower women, we are trying to look at how we can help the fisheries community or the Pacific Islanders with the rising sea level. We are just trying to make sure that we give them the economic opportunity. And that is the starting point of bringing the just mental well-being and peace in life.
What can governments do? What can nation states do in terms of regulation to, if anything, to move these policy goals along, financial inclusion and sustainable development?
Yeah, wonderful question, Ajit. I'm so glad you asked me this question. And I feel that this is something which is being recognized now. Of course, we have the Me Too movement and whatnot, but there are positive outcomes of such dialogues in the society. But if you really talk about what can be done, I would say we can have two-fold approach. The first one is looking at how we can create a talent pool, because we want to see more women at the decision-making table and the boardrooms. But if we see not many women graduating in the STEM field, we don't really see them continuing their career after they're having a baby or looking after their family, then what is the solution there? Because the body clock to become a mother and to become the next level C-suite is almost going at the same time.
Well, Sheryl Sandberg's take about lean in, you can have it all. I don't know if you can have it all. You can have most of it, but maybe not at the same time. Many specialists will tell you that there have been advances in medical technology for women to have children later in life, but even they can't fully turn the clock back.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think having it all is possible, but making peace with where you are, with what you have achieved, is very important. It goes back to what we were discussing about having fun along the way and just having a sense of gratitude. Going back to your question, I think having more women participate in the STEM field as young kids is very important. And we need policy frameworks which really incentivize people who have young girls to send them to schools which are focused on how they can be software engineers, how they could be in AI or data management. So I think that's one of the potential solutions we can look at. And the second one is the access to capital, because we no longer want to be someone's employees for the rest of our lives. We might have a brilliant idea. We want to become an entrepreneur. But what are the odds for us to raise money, especially when I don't have the land or anything in my name because it belongs to my father or my husband or my brother? So the male family members tend to have these assets in their names. I am not seen as a good borrower by the financial institution. So what can we do there? Can we have policies where we are particularly focusing on women entrepreneurs? We are promoting them. We are encouraging them to try and fail. not take it to their heart and say, look, I'm done for the rest of my life. One failed venture, one failed attempt does not make you a failure. Not trying again is what is preventing you from becoming a failure. So I think it's very important to have those policies. Because if you look at the stats, only 40% women entrepreneurs have access to capital compared to 80% male colleagues. And the same goes for the board level positions. We don't really see a lot many female CEOs. And oftentimes when we talk about a CEO, we tend to say female CEOs. So why are we having that kind of different vocabulary as well? Because we don't say a male lift man or a female lift man. It's just a lift man.
Because it's not the norm. So here we come to the concept of femtech. Do you understand that to be then trying to get more women into tech, or is femtech technology intended to make women's lives easier? I mean, well, what do you understand femtech to be?
Well, my definition, Ajay, would purely go back to 2019 when I set up the company, and the intention was to represent women in tech, femtech, and to amplify world's 50% point of view, how we can bring more women into the fintech space, how can we make women more financially resilient, and help them with mentorship as well along the way. So the element of pro bono mentorship, I think, is the crucial one, because I am where I am today because a lot of people were helping me along the way. They are the unsung heroes of my life. But if I can use my experiences, my network, and be a sponsor for someone, open those doors and pay it forward, I think that's going to be great. So that was the intention. But given my background as a lawyer and working in the tech space, of course, having worked in finance, it was a lot more easier for me to bring these angles together. We spoke about that intersection earlier and how we can help these women to be making the right decisions when it comes to identifying their career choices or raising capital and then scaling up their ventures. But at the same time, working with the regulator on sanitizing them on what these issues are, how they can be more proactive in having those policy frameworks. We spoke about the work I did with the domestic workers, having those incentives, initiatives at the grassroots level where we can help these women go from offline to online and adopt to technology to be more resilient. So I think it's an entire gamut of different ideas and initiatives, but it just boils down to having the courage to make that choice, because we always have the choice on deciding how we respond to the situations around us. And if we choose wisely, we look back and feel grateful about those choices. And I think Femtech Partners, which is based in Singapore, but now has expanded to ASEAN and Oceanic region as well after my work in the Pacific Island, is just about how we can bring women into the STEM space and how we can make them, I would say, equal to men, because women are already equal, but create a level playing field.
Fair enough. I mean, getting more women into tech, this is something people have been talking about since the latter half of the 90s when I was still in college. The discussion, the debate doesn't seem to be going away. And certainly it's a long-term endeavor. But in terms of what type of paradigm shift might be necessary, is it just a generational gap and the older generation need to die off so that there's a generational tipping point so that, people look at women differently? Is it that that's holding them back, or must we acknowledge that men and women are different, and that if women naturally gravitate towards other fields, that's okay, and that if certain women want to join the tech space, they should be encouraged, and want to enter STEM, that should be encouraged. But if we're doing it to attain some social engineering goal of parity between the genders in tech, should more resources be put into getting more women to sign up just because we think parity is a good idea?
I would say that when we talk about the mental agility and the resilience, women are, the research goes to show that women are far more stronger than men, but I don't think the competition...
But other things factor into it as well, right? That maybe they don't want to work those long hours. As you said, women choose to be mothers. if given a choice between the family and the career,
Yeah, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. That's what I wanted to say. But we have to acknowledge what COVID has brought to us. Of course, there's the good and the bad side. But the good side, I think, is about working
that
from
you
home.
could work from home and fulfill your duties.
Yeah. So
and still be in the tech space. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that is a big game changer. You can be anywhere in the world. And that also means additional work duties on women and looking after the household chores. But at the same time, I think it's very much possible now more than ever to wear both the hats. I wouldn't say you are excelling in both or failing in both. I think it's about managing. And we know that, Ajay, we wear multiple hats. I have become an author. I'm a professor. I run this consulting firm. And then there are other things that you do as well. So are you able to be a good professional at all times? Perhaps not. But I think as long as you have the right intention, you are giving yourself the training and then you're surrounding yourself with people who really believe in you, because at the end of the day, we are nothing but the people who are the sum total of who are around us. Because if there are people who believe in us and who keep giving us that right motivation, I think it's very much possible. Because I spoke about the mentorship before, and now there's the possibility of working with individuals who are your sponsors, who talk about you very highly in rooms where you have not yet entered, and they're endorsing you. They're pushing your case forward. So if we are not shy from asking for what we want, oftentimes I just reach out to people when I see someone doing something great on LinkedIn, and I ask them if they can get on a call and advise me how they did this. So I think the ability to, it goes back to what we discussed before, being a learner and a beginner's mindset, that you continue making those choices. But we certainly need more techies who are women, because when we talk about the biases that comes with technology, and we have read about it, whether it's about the screening of the CVs where the AI would certainly look for male CVs, those who have particular kind of language being put in their CV are being chosen for the role of CEO. I think if we have women, we are actually going to ensure there's diversity in the thinking mechanism and in the implementation as well, because women are more empathetic and they bring kindness at the workplace.
Well, that was the point. I do like what you said, that we are the sum total of those we interact with to some degree. In fact, there's the growing body of psychological research to claim that the adage that you're the average of the five people you associate the most, there is a body of research to suggest that that all life's claim is actually true. Whom we interact with rubs off on us. And so if these women are not interacting with people that encourage them, then we may never yet see their potential or what they may contribute and what they may contribute to the world.
Yeah.
If you were to celebrate Women's Month this month, what would you celebrate? What would be the best way to show how far women have come in your lifetime?
I think I'm going to celebrate myself, Ajay, and more than ever, this is the first time in my life where I feel freedom to be myself. So, just celebrating myself, because for the longest time, I was trying to be someone else. I was questioning myself. I was always in doubt. And this is the first time in my life where I feel pretty sure of myself, sure-footed. And I think that's what I would like to give out as a message to women, to be able to see yourself in a totality with your weaknesses and flaws, but also recognize how far you have come. And we don't need external parties telling us we are great, because we are. It's about the self-talk we do with ourselves, and then just be able to make the choices we want to make. So the freedom to celebrate ourselves just the way we are, and the freedom to choose to say yes or no, and not feel guilty about it. Not having the guilt factor is very important. Because oftentimes I say something and then I'm thinking, oh my God, I should have said something else. So I would like to get rid of that guilt once for all.
Is that would you say that social conditioning? I mean, to some extent, yeah, the external values of our communities and our families over time become our own internalized values, right? So then ends up after a while, it's not they're doing it to us, we're doing it to ourselves, we're tormenting ourselves, we're holding ourselves up to an impossible standard.
Yeah, I agree. Because these are the norms that we get, the gender norms or the cultural norms around us. And we oftentimes, as a young person, think we have to comply with it to be seen and heard in a certain way from the society. But the minute you recognize that this is toxic, this is not serving you, it is against your own self-beliefs. If you question it, if you think it's not right, you come to the conclusion that you've got to change it, feel free to drop it in the trash. And I haven't done that fully, but I think that's my goal, to recognize something is not serving me and saying, just done with it. Not going to do it again. Yeah.
And in terms of Singapore, I mean, you're clearly enjoying yourself there, and I think you found your new home. What are your impressions of its tech ecosystem and the environment for entrepreneurs?
That's a great question, Ajay. And sometimes this is being asked at multiple forums, and I think you oftentimes hear the analogy of how Singapore is able to bring out the best regardless of the size. Because when we talk about small island developing states, the SIDS, as we call them, Singapore is a member of it, and so is Fiji, so is Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu. Perhaps we haven't heard of these countries in the Pacific Islands so much, and we hear of Singapore because it's on the global map for all the good things it has done for the country, for its people, but also giving the best practices in the financial world, in the climate tech world. So to answer your question, I would say that if we could look at the four pillars of the fintech world or the tech world, the first one would be the infrastructure. So for any economy to thrive, we need to have the bottom line, the infrastructure, the fundamentals should be correct. And I think Singapore has done a great job for it, whether it's about the penetration of mobile technology, the way people are able to use internet connectivity is great, 24/7 without any disruption. So that goes to show that the infrastructure is right there for the economy to thrive on it. Then comes the talent. Is we may have great ideas. We might be thinking, oh, come on, I'm going to rule the world, but we need people to do that. So Singapore has managed to attract the best talent, and it has all the, I would say, the visas or the immigration policies that attracts such a talent. But also at the same time, I think the opportunity for peer learning from just not the government to government, the people to people relations Singapore has managed to do. It's a friendly nation, so people find it much easier to get to that country because there are four official languages. So it goes to show that the country is definitely multicultural. Go into a meeting room, you have people from all walks of life, from different nationalities. And so is the case when you are going home in the elevator, because that's how the urban planning is also designed, so that you have a good mix of Asians, Eurasians, or Malaysians and whatnot. And I think the third point would certainly be the capital, because we all need access to capital to grow our ventures into a unicorn. And Singapore has managed to do that. It's home for the billionaires of the world, but also it has managed to attract the venture capital, the private equity. It has all those vehicles available with the good tax regime. The corporate tax is just about 17%. So I think it becomes a lot more easier for startups to have that runway. And MAS, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, the financial regulator, also makes investments into startups, gives them the sandbox. I'm sure your audience know all these concepts really well of how Singapore MAS has been promoting those initiatives by walking the talk. And last but not the least, the ecosystem itself, by bringing the co-working spaces, by bringing those events, you and I have been to the FinTech Festival many times. It attracts 65,000 people from over 150 countries. So we are looking at opportunities where there's a possibility to get business done, talk about great ideas, great minds coming together. So I think all that the city-state offers is just amazing. And I've been incredibly lucky to call it my home. I've been a permanent resident for a very long time. And I think that it's a country that really attracts the talent. And I'm saying this from my personal experience, because I did allude to how my upbringing was in India and how I felt. But coming down to Singapore, you just feel that it's about what you're bringing to the table. It's not about your skin color. It's not about where you come from. So it is just about living your dream. And a person like me who's extremely passionate and driven, I think it's the right place to be.
Yeah, you said, I mean, certainly is a place for achievement-oriented people. I mean, I don't think any society is perfect. The government has to be thanked for keeping those baser instincts, those prejudices in check. And as far as your view that, you know, there's a good mix of people from different parts of the world wherever you go, that too is a conscientious policy. The Kampong, you know, mindset of a community of people from different walks of life living in the same block, in the same community, so that you don't have those types of, shall we say, ethnic ghettos. I wouldn't say we have those in Hong Kong, but it is a bit of a cliche, but there's a fair amount of truth to it. The Nepalese tend to cluster around the Jordan Road area, you know? A lot of Indians are in the Chimsa Choi area. You know, that's not to say there aren't Indians living in the Peak and the mid-levels and what have you, but you know what I'm saying. From its origins, the government did not want ethnic ghettos, ethnic enclaves. That was seen as undercutting unity. They wanted people to mix. Even though I think it's a fair statement that there's one line in the movie Crazy Rich Asians, which is actually based in truth, that you could honestly say that about half a dozen families run Singapore. I mean, I won't name names, and I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but there's I think there's a fair amount of truth to that. The author Joe Studwell gets into that in his book Asian Godfathers some years ago. It's just in paperback form right now. But yeah, I mean, in terms of what Singapore has done, and Lee Kuan Yew even said this, founder, that at independence it was poor, it was dirty, it was bleak, and he was a reformed socialist, he said, so that maybe that explains some of his statist approach, the heavy-handedness, the top-down thinking, but what did it do? He had to take land away from some of the wealthy in order to make housing more egalitarian because, you know, that's something we all need, right? Land. And it's a scarce resource, but it's something we all need. So he had to break up some of the, you know, the cartel amongst the wealthiest families of hoarding land to themselves. But something he said that I think definitely applies to the 21st century as well, which was we had to see what we could do to make ourselves relevant to the world. If we were to switch, if we were to look at academia now at Nanyang Technological University, what have your experiences there been like as a member of the mathematics faculty and teaching in the Masters in FinTech program?
Yeah, thanks, Ajay. I think something I keep as my goalpost all the time is to make sure I'm keeping myself in an environment where I'm learning. And teaching has been that one area where I feel it propels you to learn, but also it's an environment where there's an opportunity for cross-learning and also absorbing new ideas. And just before I started working with NTU, I was teaching at the Chartered Accountants Institute in Singapore. I've done teaching with SPGen, with UCL, with then other universities, of course. And I just had one guest lectureship with NTU in 2019. And I would like to believe I left a good mark that I was asked to come back and start a FinTech module. So the School of Mathematics, they offer a master's program, which is on FinTech. But I was keen to bring the element of how FinTech is used for financial inclusion, because not many people are talking about the possibility of tech as an enabler or as a force of good. And this was 2 years ago when the professor and myself sat down and we thought, okay, this is something unusual for the students to learn, especially when they are in a Singapore environment, because we don't really have the problem of unbanked or underbanked people so much.
Right.
But it is a great learning in terms of identifying how the rest of the world is operating and what the real problems are and how we can combat some of those problems with the...
It occurs to me in a stealth way that problem does exist, doesn't it? Because those domestic helpers sending their money via remittance agents who charged exorbitant fees, sending money to parts of the world where there is a heavy unbanked problem. I don't know. Is there any way that these people can be helped?
I'm glad you asked this question because that's the kind of project I did, I think, around 2 years ago with BlackRock. The initiative we were rolling out was based on the research and the first-hand interviews we did, where we realized that when Singapore had a circuit breaker, the COVID measurements that they had put in place for the city-state, whereby they did not bring remittance as an essential service.
Oh.
In simple words, that means that the domestic workers could not leave their house on the argument that they're going to Mustafa or to Palembang to transfer money to their family in Bangladesh, India, China, wherever they are. So that was a big problem for them, because we are talking about a pandemic that was capturing the world globally, but also how we're going to make sure that these families are fed. So we tried to maneuver that problem with definitely a step-by-step approach. But to answer your question, you're absolutely right. And I was also taken aback being in Singapore for such a long time, only to realize that there is a problem of unbanked people. It's just that we don't come across those people day in, day out, because we don't interact with them. But when we talk about the blue-collar workers and the foreign domestic workers, certainly they are the people who need access to banking and financial services. So to bring down the example of how we solved the problem of these domestic workers was just to work with an NGO that ties up with these domestic workers, and they have a network of all the domestic workers who are the members. So it's a membership-led organization called IDA. They're doing an amazing job. Those who don't know about it should look it up, because I was just mind-blown to understand about their modus operandi and how they have been helping these maids for such a long time in Singapore. And we started off by working with the employers, requesting them to give the salary as the e-money, digital money, into the wallet of these workers. So once the money came into their wallet, we told these workers on different apps they could use. And I'm telling you, Ajay, this was a better off solution, because they are bypassing the legacy institutions. They're paying just a quarter of the fee they were paying earlier, and it's the click of a button. So they were using these remittance providers, which are efficient, 24/7, don't have to queue outside. And there's transparency. You exactly know how much you're paying. And therefore, that journey started of sending money back home. But to my sheer delight, it didn't end there. It was carried forward for the financial investments. And when we did the monitoring evaluation 2 years down the line, we learned some of these workers bought a house back home. They were investing in cryptos. They were using Grab, $1 investment platform, the robo advisory. So I think it was just about channelizing that energy in them, giving them the right skills and the tools, and off they go. So that has been the most interesting part of my career, I would say.
Before we move on, I'd like to come back to your book, One Stop. So if you were to distill down, what are the policy prescriptions you advocate in the book?
And so I think when we talk about these apps, we are certainly looking at the data privacy, because no matter which country we are going to pick in the world, and if you talk about the top tech giants that we cannot live without, whether it's Amazon, Facebook, we have seen our data being compromised every now and then. And therefore, that's the number one ask when we work with such companies, because they are trying to be bringing in the metadata, and they're trying to crystallize that data into identifying how the customer thinks, what kind of behavior they have. So it's very important that we exactly know what is being taken, where it is going to be used, and how long you're going to store that data. So I think that's number one. And that also stood out when I was talking to Sarichia, who's the governor for the Central Bank of Cambodia. She's the first woman and very young person to be having to be placed in that position. And she widely spoke about how comfortable she is by being a regulator where she's playing a catch-up, because she thinks that as a regulator, it's important to take a back seat and let the innovation thrive. But having said that, when we look at the compromising of data, I think that's something where regulators are taking it as a wake-up call and working towards it. And I think the two other things that really stood out for me, and this is also because of my sustainability hat that I continue to wear, would be the consumer protection, because oftentimes we're talking about people who don't really have enough knowledge on how to use these apps. Because if we look at Nigeria and the adoption of women going for such apps, you tend to see they don't really go forward. And the reasons being trust, education, and the digital literacy angle. So how can we bring forward the consumer protection and making sure that especially women who don't really have that kind of confidence when it comes to using digital tools, because women tend to be fighting financial, gender, digital divide oftentimes, how can we look at that problem with new lens and solve it? And certainly the last would be the cybersecurity issue, because again, we're talking about these apps which have not only just our data, but also our money. They're linked to our bank account. So if there's a cyber hack or an attack, what's going to happen? So I think these issues are certainly very prominent, and the answer lies in how well aware the regulator is. But oftentimes there's a capacity issue. There is the overlapping of different regulators on the same aspect of law, and therefore there's no easy solution. And of course, we can talk about having the guardrails across and having the pollination of ideas from different jurisdictions as well. But I think this exercise takes time. So certainly I've talked about these three angles in the book. But I think the big takeaway, if you ask me, is certainly on the nexus between super apps and the financial resilience of these women.
Yeah, I mean, certainly your point about sometimes multiple regulators and concurrent jurisdiction, that can complicate things. Singapore, I think you're fortunate you have the MAS that oversees the entire financial services, banking, securities, futures, insurance. Hong Kong, we have several regulators. And I guess it's up to each society to decide what's right for them. I do think a unified regulator would greatly simplify things. But profession here feels differently. I mean, we have the HKMA, and they oversee all things that banks do, both in the banking and the securities and the insurance arenas. But if we stick with the academic thread here, as young graduates go out there, whether they've studied law, business, or a more technical subject, technology is going to be a big part of their lives professionally and personally in a big way. In fact, an earlier guest even said that Generation Z, the Zoomers, have little to no say in the construction and governance, the financial infrastructure that will govern their lives. And if anyone's wondering, that was a few episodes back with Brian Michael. And I think there's a fair amount of truth to that. But if you're looking at this as a young law graduate or young business graduate, either at HKU, because, I mean, I do have to ask the question because we are affiliated with the university and a law school. If you're a young graduate, you've studied law, you've studied business, and you want to enter a technical field like this, what advice would you give them, especially given your own intriguing path into the subject?
Yeah, I mean, if I had to say something to my younger self or to a young law graduate, I would say that keep an open mind and don't have very rigid ideas of how you want your career to be. Had I imagined that this is how my career is going to look 18 years down the line after I graduated, not at all. Of course, when I look back, it seems like a perfect story. But I got to tell you, it is not the same every day, especially because when you're venturing into new areas where you're starting off as a beginner, you have to really slog it off. So I think the three pieces of advice would be never say never. If you find a good opportunity, and if you think money's not that great, but the opportunity to learn is fantastic, say yes. The second would be just to be open-minded. You never know what might lead to your ultimate dream. So continue doing what's best for you right now and keep making that next step and be consistent. And lastly, I would say to have fun along the way, because it's a short life. We don't know whether tomorrow is promised or not. So it's very pertinent to just enjoy what you're doing. And if your work seems like drudgery. It seems like something that takes away your bliss. I don't think you should be doing that, because our goal is to go from piss to bliss. So it's important to really enjoy the journey.
You know, that's a valid point, but all too often with Asian parents, I do think the expectation is, okay, there's a timeline. You get your studies out of the way by such and such age. If we're sticking to the legal exam, you get a certain amount of work experience, then you go back for your MBA, or you get your practice certificate, then you start practicing. You choose the path, you're the barrister or solicitor. You know, you make partner by a certain age. And, you know, this dawned on someone I know once. And the guy just broke down on the steps of the cook. He ran into one of the older students, who was by this point several years ahead of him in the profession. The guy just broke down. He was at the court. He was filing something, and he was broke down in tears. And the former student said to him, look, if you're that unhappy in the legal profession now, you're on a cusp, right? If you stick around into year three, year four, year five, you will have attained a certain degree of seniority in the profession. People will look at you a certain way. Along with that comes social respect and prestige and an increase in your income. At that point, it'll be harder for you to walk away.
Yeah, I think sometimes you have to put on your blinders and forget what naysayers have to say. And I'm saying this because I walked down the path, especially as, I don't want to bring the color, but a brown person, a woman.
Yeah.
It is not easy. Sometimes you're the only person in the room and people make fun of you. They say, oh, you just happen to be a lawyer and you just happen to know technology. And I'm thinking to myself, really? I studied so hard.
Then as though you fluked your way into it. You just fell into it.
Just fell into my lap. And someone just said, look, you're a lawyer starting today. And I have done multiple degrees and diplomas. So I think it comes with age as well, that grace to take the negative and the positive with the same grace. But I feel that growing up in Delhi, because we did speak about it earlier, it really makes you a thick-skinned person.
But it's a political cynic. No, seriously, some of the snarkiest, most vicious people that really get under your skin and engage in psychological warfare and make you question your self-worth, I have met in Delhi. And it's a political city on multiple levels.
You're right. So I think... you have to give yourself credit for what you have done, even if these are small wins, and celebrate yourself, because if you can look into the mirror and feel awe and proud of the journey you have had, I'm very sure those small wins is going to translate into something bigger and bigger. And I'm saying this because I would take public transport as a young girl in Delhi, which was far from easy. We oftentimes use the word ink teasing, which is particularly used in India in context to how men would look at you in a certain way or touch you or make you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I think starting off your day like that and then walking into school thinking, look, I'm going to forget about how bad that was and just focus on learning now. I think that really changes the dynamics for you. And very early on, my father told me that, look, I have no money or the connections. So you got to work hard. If you want this life, it's all yours for you to go out and achieve it. So I think having that reality check at a young age that, okay, if you want to dream on, dare to dream on, and then dare to do all the things that take you to that goal. So I feel blessed to have that journey where, you know, you never felt like it's just going to happen to you because you know someone, because someone can throw money and you will get things done.
Oneeha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ajay, for having me. This was a great discussion and I like how candid it works.
No, I appreciate it. And I have to have you back on again sometime. And to our listeners, thank you. Until next time.